Over the past decade, output from American factories has risen by a third, while in roughly the same period, one-third of all the manufacturing jobs have disappeared. Adam Davidson, the co-host of NPR's Planet Money, has written about this phenomenon in the January-February issue of The Atlantic magazine, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Good to be here.
You note that we still make things in the United States, even though many people don't believe you when you tell them that. What makes up the base of American manufacturing today?
I'd say the key word is adaptability, that the way America has competed is basically to almost completely cede the entire field of high production, you know, lots and lots of commodity products, white T-shirts, assembling computers and electronic equipment, things like that. China just really does do that much, much cheaper than almost any company can.
You almost said and better.
I almost said and better. I guess you're right, exactly. I mean, what we do, and I guess you could say better. I mean, they serve the purposes of, you know, when Apple wants iPhones, as we're learning, that they serve those needs better than any American company can. But,
are people totally aware of it? I overheard a conversation, a man complaining that his wife had bought what he calls some cheap Chinese item. He was saying it to her over his iPhone.
Right.
And I didn't say to him, do you realize you're speaking into a Chinese manufactured product?
And probably wearing a Chinese manufactured product. And China, when the first time I went to China and visited some factories, a longtime consultant there told me, China is so big and changing so fast that everything you can say about it is true. So China still does have some of the worst factories in the world with some of the worst conditions imaginable, churning out some of the worst garbage you could think of. It also has some of the most cutting-edge, amazing factories doing the most high-end stuff you could imagine. And, you know, a lot of times American manufacturers will visit competing factories in China, and it's not just they have more workers. They have better equipment, newer equipment. China, it's impossible to say any one sentence that conveys everything.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, the point of what America does really well is responsiveness. So I think about fashion. You know, a white T-shirt that is going to be the same 6 months from now and 6 months from then, let China do that. That's the view of American business. But a fashionable T-shirt or a trendy T-shirt, so, you know, maybe Target is going to find out that little girls really like pink shirts with unicorns this month, but next month they really want purple shirts with rainbows on them. Those are the kinds of things that American companies can respond to more quickly. So we do still make garments and apparel. We certainly design an incredible amount of garments and apparel. We also make lots and lots of high-end medical devices that require a very deep understanding of the customer base, the big hospitals, for example, and also a real nimbleness, a real ability to be on top of trends, to be very quick to market. So America does have a competitive advantage in those areas, turnaround.
Do the kinds of jobs that are still available today tend to be high skill or lower skill?
I mean, there still are low-skill manufacturing jobs in America, but that's where the hollowing out is. That's, something like 6 million jobs lost in the last decade, just a real shocking loss of low-skill jobs. And by the way, whenever I say this thing low-skill or unskilled jobs, people get mad because, you know, any job takes some skill. But generally, the way a manufacturer would describe that is a job that almost anybody could be trained to do it within a day. And there are still those jobs, but there's few of them. You know, that really is where China and Mexico and Central America, low-wage countries, have really taken those jobs. The jobs that are left, there are fewer of them, but they tend to be more higher skill. They're more intellectually, challenging. You still might be talking about someone without a college degree, but probably someone with a high school degree and some additional technical training who's really solving problems. They're not just performing a routine task. They're looking at how a machine is making something and figuring out how to make it better or how to fix a problem that's sprung up, that kind of thing. So they probably pay more, they're probably more satisfying, but there's a lot fewer of those jobs.
Well, we hear a lot about China, but how big a role has NAFTA played in the transformation of American manufacturing? You mentioned Latin America as one of the places where the lower-skilled jobs are going.
Yeah, certainly. And NAFTA and then DR-CAFTA, the Dominican Republic Central American Free Trade Agreement, also had a huge influence. And there's something called the Caribbean Basin Initiative, which gave preferential trade deal to lots of Caribbean countries. That has had a huge impact in textiles and apparel, the Central American Caribbean stuff. I mean, if you go to Alabama or North Carolina, South Carolina, you know, those are people who feel they've lost their jobs to Central and Southern Latin America, not to China as much. And obviously Mexico with the maquilas along the border, you know, they're able to do something China can't do, which is make something today and have it to someone in the U.S. tomorrow or 3 days later. And so there is a lot of competition for the heavier stuff or the stuff that needs to be really quick and responsive, things that the customer doesn't want to just let it be on a boat for a month. They want to have it right away. That's certainly a big competitive pressure.
Is there any irony in the fact that that some of these jobs that used to be in the Northeast, but then moved to right-to-work states in the South, are now leaving those right-to-work states in search of even cheaper labor?
I mean, it's amazing when you start reading the history how predictable this is. I mean, you look at, you know, 1500s England and you know, the very early, you know, almost pre-industrial revolution automation is basically a phenomenon in Leeds. And then, it, you know, and everyone in Leeds is saying, oh, my goodness, you know, Newcastle or you know, London are going to steal all our jobs. And then, you know, and then some people take some of those skills and bring them across the channel to France and Germany. And then, you know, famously, some New England entrepreneurs stole some of the technology and brought it to New England, and then it moves to the South, and then moves further south, and then moves to China. The low-end textile and apparel just tends to be something. It tends to be a first step on the industrialization ladder because, you know, buying a bunch of sewing machines, training people, it's fairly low cost. You and I could, maybe for $500,000, we could set up a T-shirt sewing operation almost anywhere in the world. And now the managers know how to train up a group of subsistence farmers to be sewing T-shirts pretty quickly. And so that's a very portable, very, you know, easy to move business almost anywhere that has some degree of political stability and, you know, some rule of law. Then what the hope is that behind that comes more industrialization, higher end stuff, higher value stuff, so that workers can get better jobs. That's the part that does seem to be breaking down, that it's not so clear what comes after those low-wage jobs disappear for everybody. I mean, clearly some people benefit tremendously, but some people just don't seem to get that next wave of economic opportunity.
I was surprised to read that about as many Americans work in factories today as did at the end of the Depression. The difference is that our population has doubled since then.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really striking. I mean, even though I this big article I wrote for The Atlantic, I went into basically knowing. I mean, I said on the radio, you know, manufacturing work has hollowed out. But when I saw the data, it still was just shocking. First of all, it happened more abruptly than I realized. I mean, there's just from World War II until the late 70s, there's just this real, you know, just a spike upwards, just every year, more and more jobs. And then there's sort of a small dip and a leveling out. But the real collapse of manufacturing employment is the last 10 or 12 years. I mean, I think I didn't realize it was that fresh and that recent. I thought it had started earlier. And the fact that in 10 or 12 years, you can basically see the complete erasure of 60 years of development, you know, it shows you how abrupt this is. I mean, what economists will say is, you know, an economy can adapt to change. That's what capitalist economies are really good at. But it takes a while. And so when the change happens over generations, you can slowly adapt. You can train people differently. You can create different incentives. But when it happens in 10 years, it's just extremely difficult to respond to such a violent change.
How have robotics and computer technology changed American factories?
So this is the big untold story. This is a much bigger impact. This has a much bigger impact than trade with China or NAFTA or anything else by several degrees. I mean, if you when you go to a factory, it's really amazing. There's been huge advances in machining technology over the last 10 or 20 years. You know, just the level of computerization and automation is just remarkable. And so, you know, you really see, you know, one person running a very fancy machine that does everything that 100 people did just a few decades ago, to the point where almost anything that can be routinized, anything that can be programmed, that's being done by a machine. And the person is there just to make sure the machine is doing it right, to program the computers that run the machines, et cetera. And that's a much bigger impact than the kind of classic, you know, transfer of the jobs to a lower wage country.
So skilled workers are there really to do the jobs that computers can't do, the ones that require human judgment. But I'm assuming that someone is working on a program that can take care of that as well.
Absolutely. And you and I should be worried if someone's working on a journalist robot.
Well, I have seen I've seen a few talk show hosts who I thought were rather robotic, so
fair enough. Yeah.
I'm sure it's already happening. Haven't most of the high-skilled jobs required to manufacture things like computers and smartphones moved to Asia? Don't they really require a lot of human input?
Yeah, I mean, the stuff China does is really the final assembly. So the silicon, you know, chips, those can be made in the U.S. or Japan or Korea. The you know, the fancier electronic parts will be made in, you know, Japan or Korea, and to some extent still in the U.S. What China does, you know, when you hear, oh, China makes all our iPhones, what that really means is China gets a bunch of boxes filled with parts that were made in a much richer country by much better paid and more highly skilled workers, and then the Chinese workers just kind of put them all together. They assemble the product, which actually is not a huge value added. That's not where the real profit is. The real profit is actually in the intellectual property, so Apple gets that, and in making the really high-end, cutting-edge stuff, which, you know, is more likely to be Japan or Korea.
I'm talking on Backstory with Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money. He wrote an article called Making It in America. That's in the January-February issue of The Atlantic. The company you looked at for your story, Standard Motor Products, makes replacement auto parts. Do they have to compete on an international scale?
Absolutely, yeah. They're very interesting company based here in Long Island City, Queens.
But they don't make anything in New York City.
No, although I was surprised to learn as recently as 2007 they were still making replacement parts in Queens. Although, to be honest, I think that was probably a bad financial decision. They did it, you know, because it's still a family-run company, and they were really reluctant to lay off people who had worked there forever. But yeah, I mean, what really struck me, and I don't think I had fully appreciated this, is Standard Motor Products, like it turns out, I think most manufacturing companies, is constantly studying what should we make here, what should we make in Mexico. They own a couple plants in Mexico. What should we make in Poland, where they own a plant, and what should we import from China? And you know, if you just look at any auto part that has a bunch of little, you know, you can imagine a fuel injector or spark plug or whatever. It's got lots of little bits in there, little screws and little parts. You know, they're constantly evaluating every one of those parts and deciding, you know, can we, you know, bang out those screws more quickly, or should we just buy a bunch of those from China, or is there, you know, someone in North Carolina who's making them? And it's a constant review of the global economy all the time that has surprising results. I mean, it's not, you know, the net impact is more stuff gets imported from China than gets exported to China. There's no question China ends up the big winner. But there are, within that, companies in America who are constantly finding little niches, little ways to beat their China competition.
Well, in the old days, we heard that a city like New York, with its wide population base, was ideal for manufacturing because you can get highly skilled workers, low-skilled workers, and everything in between. And I've heard that some mayors, like Ed Koch, instituted policies that encourage manufacturers to leave because they had a different vision of what New York City should be like.
Yeah, I mean, New York, people say New York used to be the China of the world. We used to make, you know, some huge percentage of the manufactured goods, certainly for the U.S. And this relationship, this is a big topic among city economic development officers and mayors, and is, you know, what kind of manufacturing do we want? The trend now is to really want the stuff that employs high-skill, high-wage people, because obviously they're more likely to pay more in taxes, to, you know, buy nicer homes, and et cetera, et cetera, and to discourage the stuff that creates low-wage jobs. It's not hard to discourage that because there just aren't a lot of those jobs left. But the result is in, you know, cities all over the country, you see these large populations that used to have such a great base of employment. It's just not clear what those people are going to do. I lived in Chicago for a long time, and much of the South Side, I mean, with the hollowing out of the steel industry, it's just millions of people left with no economic logic to their lives. It's very grim.
Toyota recently announced that it would move more manufacturing jobs from Japan to the United States. And one of our listeners, Antonio in Bayside, asks, the economist Richard Wolf says that the surge in U.S. manufacturing recently has been due to depressed wages, making it more attractive than sending jobs overseas. Is that true?
I haven't seen depressed wages. I mean, certainly wages are not rising particularly fast, but I don't think we've seen a lot of wage reductions.
Well, we've seen the loss of a lot of union jobs.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I assume they meant just in the last couple of years. Yes, I mean, there's a huge move of manufacturing from, you know, heavily unionized north to, you know, not unionized at all south. You know, this I-85 corridor, which extends from southern Virginia to Montgomery, Alabama, you know, just amazing. You know, that's basically where all those Rust Belt factories ended up, and, you know, just probably not a union member in the whole hundreds of miles of space there. With autos, it's weird, though, because it often, I mean, it's unlikely that someone would leave Japan for the U.S. Entirely because of wages. A lot of times that has to do with currency and, you know, keeping manufacturing something in a yen country and selling it in a dollar country, the currency risk can be much more of an influence than wages.
Another listener, Amy in Manhattan, wonders about the other costs, the way workers are treated in terms of safety and other working conditions in these high-end factories in Japan. Are American factories better environmentally? Is that a reason that things cost more money to manufacture here?
I mean, Japan is pretty much at our level or higher than our level. I mean, China, you know, you hear more talk of that. Certainly within China, a worker would much rather work for a factory making stuff for Americans than a factory making stuff for Chinese people, because the internal market factories are much, much worse than the external market factories, which isn't to say the exporting factories are great. I mean, obviously, you know, the New York Times series on the iPhone and et cetera, we know that those factories are pretty, you know, there are very tough conditions. The way economists talk about that is this phrase externalities, that within the product or the manufacturing process, there are these external costs, environmental costs, labor costs, that the factory itself doesn't have to bear. So they end up being less, you know, less concerned with that stuff. But it's very hard in a world without a single world government to figure out how to impose those costs across borders.
Isn't a lot of the manufacturing in China supported and subsidized by the state? Many people have said that the route to reviving American manufacturing would be to get the Chinese to stop manipulating their currency. Do you think that that would make much of a difference?
I mean, I think that would make a difference. I don't think it would make a difference in a binary sense that, you know, if China stops manipulating its currency, we're suddenly going to see a flourishing of low-wage jobs. But it would have the you know, it would make it easier for U.S. manufacturers to compete, which is helpful. I mean, the Chinese economy obviously is a very, very government-controlled economy, and that is you know, to some degree, that is hurting our own competitiveness. But people are beginning to wonder how long China can do that. It's one thing to have a very government-focused program when you're doing what's called catch-up growth, when you're just trying to copy what America and Japan and Korea already know how to do. It's something else altogether when China tries to enter the next phase of actually being a major innovator and a major high value-added producer. It's not so clear that the government can hold your hand and manipulate things and make that work so well. So,
and Japan and Korea originally, for many years, did make the inexpensive products, but then workers started demanding better conditions, and they wound up not being able to compete all that much on price.
Right, and I mean, in a lot of ways, I think Korea is the poster child for modern industrial capitalism. It's, you know, even though, you know, it's a place, it was a very poor agrarian place. I was looking for some statistics that in the 60s it was roughly on par with Haiti, and you know, and it started making, you know, cheap, kind of not that well-made stuff for external markets, for export, and slowly developed more and more skills, and the country developed into a prosperous middle-class country. And that, you know, that's the dream. That's why so many countries are excited to enter this. That hasn't worked for Japan, too. I mean, if you just roll the clock back a couple decades, Japan as well. Of course, both those countries, the governments had very strong interventions to make it happen the way they want. And in the case of Japan, that seems to have stopped helping them so much and has begun to hurt them.
But we have just signed a free trade agreement with Korea.
We have. Yes. Which is as big a debate within Korea as it is here. You know, the farmers are freaking out over
it. Okay, so let's talk about the situation here. Some people suggest we romanticize manufacturing, but in his recent State of the Union address, President Obama put a number of tax proposals on the table to try and revive American manufacturing. Tax breaks for companies that create jobs in the U.S., increased deductions for high-tech manufacturers, a minimum tax on multinational companies that make profits overseas. There's one of the issues that's come up in this campaign is the bailouts and restructuring of the auto industry. Not everybody is in support of what happened there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think most economists would be with Christina Romer, who, you know, the president's former economic advisor, who wrote in the New York Times this week that we really shouldn't be, the government shouldn't be saying we like manufacturing more than the service sector. The service sector, by the way, is not just lousy jobs at Walmart. I mean, you and I work in the service sector. Doctors do, engineers do. It's anybody who gets paid for doing something rather than making something. And that clearly is the most profitable way of being an American. And it's nothing to sneeze at. It's you know, the service sector is a very good, very vibrant, you know, economic driver. And I do think there is a romanticization about manufacturing. I mean, I love going to a factory. There's something really cool about seeing things being made. But an economy doesn't inherently need to physically make products. You know, if people are willing to pay us for doing things rather than making things, that's a perfectly good way to have an economy, and in many ways can be more adaptable because you don't have to.
Adam Davidson is co-host of NPR's Planet Money. His article, Making It in America, is in the January-February issue of The Atlantic magazine. Sorry to interrupt you. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.